I wanted to bring you on today. I wanted to talk primarily about Freud's seduction theory and the kind of thought or argument that he abandoned it at some point. But before we get to that, can you kind of, from your understanding, what was the, when Freud came onto the scene, or let's start even before Freud came onto the scene, what was trauma theory like in those days?
I'm not an expert on this. I do teach the history of psychology, and I failed to mention that I'm a faculty member at Xavier University, and the models of mental illness that predated Freud, and Freud really was inventing a lot of what he was doing, and a lot of what he was doing was based on his own experience of himself and his own experience of his own mind and how his mind worked. And I think you're asking about this, just kind of opens my eyes to the, I think the mental illness was seen as either something that was biologically caused, or something that was caused by some kind of moral failing, some kind of failure in the kind of upbringing that would have led someone to function in a morally upright, in an acceptable manner. And I think that part of what Freud did was to clarify that events in people's lives derail them. And seduction is a euphemism. What we're really talking about is child abuse and primarily incest. And he was impressed that in the he was trained as a neurologist. He was and a bench scientist. He studied neurons by looking through a microscope at the neurons, and was trained in kind of the rigorous science of the day. But he wanted to get married, and he was never going to become a professor in Austria because the emperor wouldn't assign anyone to become to work at the university who was Jewish. So he had to go into private practice. He became a physician in order to go into private practice. And he was treating nervous disorders, meaning nerve problems. And he went to France and studied with Charcot, who was a hypnotist, and was thinking, but also a neurologist, and thinking about the brain. And he was impressed as he was working with a man named Brouwer, back in Vienna, in Austria, that their patients and his patients, 20 out of 20 of them had a history of having been sexually abused. And he said, this can't be accidental. This must be an important part of their pathology of the difficulties that they're having. And so he, his original model of mental illness was that it was caused by sexual trauma, that it was caused by some event in the environment that interfered with, and he's also very much a developmental psychologist, that interfered with normal development. I think that he, and then what Masson maintains is that he abandoned that theory. I've never read Masson, and partly I didn't read him because I don't know when he wrote, but was at Menninger in the late 1980s and early 1990s, and Masson was being talked about there. And people were saying, oh, come on, we've always known that as we're treating people, that sexual trauma is frequently a part of the histories of our patients. And we've never believed that that was not the case. And Masson was kind of accusing not just Freud of abandoning the seduction theory, the sexual trauma theory, but he was accusing the entire profession of doing that. And that was not my experience. We were we had a treatment unit that was dedicated to helping people recover from that. And also, I was working as a clinician treating incest offenders, people who had offended against their children. So I didn't doubt that that sexual abuse was a significant component in the ways that some people got off track. That said, Freud discovered that he himself was depressed. He didn't have a history of sexual trauma himself. He treated his daughter, Anna Freud. He analyzed her. That's not something that we would do now. I can't imagine lying down on a couch with my dad sitting behind me and saying whatever came into my mind. I'm not going there. But he knew that she had not been sexually abused. So he began to... And she and other patients had fantasies about the possibility of or he wrote a paper called A Child Is Being Beaten, which I think is related to Anna Freud's experience that there was actually envy of people who got the special attention of being beaten or being abused, of being cared for in that way, of being special in that way. And so he began to think about other ways, in addition to sexual trauma, that could lead to psychopathology. And he became convinced that fantasy was an important component of that. And I think he added that to his way of thinking. And that led to his thinking about our having not just things that we're unaware of, not just things that are out. The unconscious is not just something that's stuff that we... can't quite remember, but it's an active functional part of the mind that organizes and makes sense of our experience in ways that aren't necessarily product of an actual experience, but can be the product of fantasy.
Yeah. Okay. That's a good rundown. The are you saying that kind of the Freud's trauma model? That's another way of phrasing or understanding the seduction theory, because, as you said, seduction is a euphemism there. It's more childhood sexual abuse. So it's more of a trauma model that he first formulated.
Absolutely.
Okay. Yes. That helps. Thank you. And then it wasn't that. So I'm kind of catching up to all of this. You know, I was born in like 91. So in the 80s and early 90s, when all of this was, I think Masson kind of brought up these kind of arguments or accusations or however you want to think of them. And then people started writing a lot more on the seduction theory. And from my understanding, in the 80s, there was what some people called Freud bashers. There was a lot of Freud critics and books going around. From what I've been able to kind of conclude is that there are kind of four different ways of thinking about Freud's seduction theory. And then, so one is that he abandoned it in favor of the psychic theory, because that seemed to explain things better, more fantasy, the Oedipal complex. The second is that Masson, he abandoned it because it was, he had negative pressure from the scientific world, and the world was not ready to hear about that tragedy. The third was that there were no actual reports of childhood sexual abuse, that Freud had that theory, and then his early patients, that they were like reconstructed memories, that Freud was projecting that into the session, and that if people assented, then that was proof, or if they rejected that, that never happened, that was resistance. I don't know.
And also somehow proof, right?
Yeah. Yeah, those are more of the I think, from what I understand, the critics say that, I guess even is the etiology of hysteria, Freud talked about that they were, the childhood sexual abuse was unconscious, and that the patients didn't bring it in. It was uncovered or discovered through analysis. So I think critics would say that it was not like people came in saying
that it was suggested.
Yeah.
And that the suggestion was something that people were happy to take to be relieved of the burden of either of having been abused. I wasn't really abused. I imagined it. Or, and I think both sides of this were argued. The other side was they weren't abused, but they were told they were abused, and then they felt good about that. That relieved them of the burden of their having done something. And so they latched onto that, even though that wasn't the case. I think one of the things that Freud was wrong about, he was wrong about a lot of stuff. And so I think part of what happens with Freud bashing is that people go back and they attack Freud rather than connecting with contemporary psychoanalytic thinking, which is, it's a huge volume of work that's gone on, that's morphed and changed the way that we think about the mind. And the mind is endlessly complex. And so that's one of the reasons that, at least to me, psychodynamic thinking is so enticing, is because it does propose theories that make sense of the mind in some ways and other ways don't. One of Freud's assumptions was that our memory is veridical, that we have, that we can access what actually happened. And I think that contemporary neuroscience, and by the way, he abandoned neuroscience. He said it's going to take 100 years before we have a model of the mind that's going to work. So I'm going to have to become a psychologist, as if that were a lesser profession. But I think that neurology is living up to his prediction, and we are learning much more about how the brain works, and that helps us get a better understanding of how consciousness and unconscious functions work. But he had the belief that memory is it's like a record player or a tape machine, and that we play the tape back, and our current science suggests that memory is reconstructive. And that leaves open the possibility of both erasing things that are unpleasant, but also of fabricating things that didn't happen. I can give you an example from my life that it's minor trauma. It's not, but one of the things that my father did when I was a child, when we would act up in the back seat, he would put us on the side of the road and go around the block. And we would experience the terror of being abandoned. I have very vivid memories. We lived in South Florida at the time, and I have very vivid memories of being left on the street in Miami among the tallest buildings I had ever seen, and just feeling absolutely terrified. My mother was not a big fan of this, but it was kind of the way that things were done in his family, I think. And so so in talking about that, I talked with her about a memory that I had, and she claimed that that didn't happen. Now, she and I differ about a lot of things that did or didn't take place in my childhood. This is a place where I think she's right, but I have a very, very strong, very vivid memory of Dad putting me out. I had a brother and a sister, and so whoever was picked as the offender was left out. And it was night, and he drove off, and then I went and hid in the bushes. And they came back, and they couldn't find me, and they were terrified. They didn't know what had happened to me. And then I emerged from the bushes, and they were relieved. My mother said that never happened. I would have remembered that. And then as I interrogated this memory, the landscape of it doesn't make sense. It's the front yard of my grandmother's house. And I'm hiding in the bushes in my grandmother's house. There's no way he would have put us out there, put me out there, that I would have just gone in the house and said, "Grandmother, I'm here." So I think I borrowed a scenario and created it. And I think that was a reparative fantasy. It was, I don't know whether it started as a dream somehow it jumped the tracks and got encoded as a memory. It was something that I created. Just as when I'm remembering the experience in Miami, I'm really creating that. I know there were tall buildings. I don't, can I tell you what the names on the building were, or who the people were, that's a memory, but it's not a tape. In fact, the memory of the fantasy has many more specific elements in it than the actual memory of what happened in Miami. So I think that I think one of the places that we got into trouble is that therapy led to courtroom situations. And is this memory exactly what happened or not? We've got all kinds of evidence suggesting that we're very open to suggestion when we're prompted about how to remember things. And so that becomes very controversial in terms of what happens in a clinical situation. And I think what we're trying to get at is the emotional experience that someone had. And that's what's most important to us clinically. And I think that however that emotion gets cloaked in what happened, it's the affect, the emotion that we're trying to get to. But in a courtroom, what they're trying to get at is what happened out there. Well, that's a very different thing. And we're using, when we start using information from a therapy session to evaluate what did or didn't happen, we're on less solid ground. That's not to say that we should discount the memories at all, but it is to say that we should be contextualizing how it is that we gained that information, where it's veridical, and trying to match it up. But to do that in a courtroom where the consequences of this are tremendous, is a very complicated process.
Yeah, it sounds like that was kind of the fourth position that people take, is that he never denied the trauma theory. He just brought in the fact that there is a psychic reality, and sometimes it says it was a matter of the proper proportion between these two complementary realms, a matter of emphasis, not of repudiation. Is the emphasis on the actual fact of something happening, or is the emphasis on the psychic reality of that having happened, or the emotional,
right, the psychic affectation?
I'm kind of pleased to hear that from all of the reading, it seems to me that to say that he abandoned the trauma theory is a bit of a misnomer, that he didn't abandon it. He just emphasized psychic reality more in the later writings. It does seem, though, that and it makes sense what you're saying about when it comes to courtrooms. And I read somewhere that he was trying to develop something that, like you said, whether or not it happened, you could have a universal explanation of neuroses. So whether or not some people are abused, some people have those types of traumas and some people don't, and people with the trauma can wind up, let's say, depressed or hysterical back then, and people without the trauma could wind up depressed or hysterical. So what could be more of a universal explanation? It seems that you were saying that in your experience, people didn't discount the actual happenings, that you even worked with, like you said, the offenders. Masson, he talks about in his training, it was kind of like, it's probably all fantasy. It probably didn't really happen. It's just that it's like a wish fulfillment type of thing. And I was like, well, maybe that was just his experience. And I found this interesting quote.
I don't doubt that did take place. I think that there are very, I think there's all kinds of interesting motives for that. I think that, and ironically, it's psychoanalysis that's going to give us motives to explain the kinds of distortions that psychoanalysts and other and introduced into the work that they did. I think it is horrifying to imagine that we could abuse children in the way that children have been abused, and I think that it is that part of what Freud implicitly was suggesting, I don't think that he was as articulate about this as he might have been, is that our love for children, especially when you have a theory that involves only two drives, sex and aggression, that there's a sexual component to that. He didn't have attachment as a piece of that. And so the idea that I'm sexually drawn to my children, which I think there's something to that, and certainly that gets acted out with some individuals, but I think that there's that becomes a horrifying thought. So I don't know that this is something, and then we project that. It's the kids that want to have they're the ones who are sexually driven, according to Freudian theory, because that's the drive that's being expressed as a child. And we're going back, way back in time, to Freud's position that there were only these two drives. And modern neurological theories suggest that there are at least six or seven drive pathways, and that those are all operative and engaged with each other in interesting, complicated ways. But anyway, I think that I think that there were people who said, no, you should approach your patients with the assumption that their childhood experiences were imagined on their part. And that, I think, has as much to do with the pathology of the treaters as it does. And so Masson is right to be, but I don't think that's Freud. Freud was actually quite, I mean, one of the thoughts was that he kind of caved under the people did not like his idea that sexuality was one of our prime drivers. But he stuck with that essentially to the end. He was never convinced otherwise. And that took tremendous personal courage on his part. And I don't think that he was afraid to say that that he believed his patients when they said that they had been sexually abused. I think others did. And I think Masson is conflating them with Freud. And that, not having read Masson, so I'm imagining this is my fantasy. But I think that he's conflating them with Freud, which I think is his problem.
Hmm. You said Freud was wrong about a lot of things. The Oedipal complex. It seemed that he believed that psychoanalysis rested upon that theory. And Masson quoted a letter from Anna Freud where she said to abandon the Oedipus complex, you would also abandon the whole importance of fantasy life, conscious or unconscious fantasy, and there would have been no psychoanalysis afterwards. Is that something that you think that they were wrong? Like, where does the Oedipus complex stand in contemporary psychoanalytic thinking? And why would they think that?
I think that the Oedipus complex continues to have an important part in analytic thinking. But this is the way that I think about this as a contemporary analyst. And by the way, one of the resources that I think is really helpful, one of the I'll call it great books of the 20th century, is Daniel Stern's book about that comes from an analytically informed observation of infant development, which is different than reconstruction. So he's observing, for instance, newborns, and what can they and can't they, and how do they perceive the world? How do they make sense of it? How are they engaged with it? And then follows them through childhood. And I think that one of the things that Stern clarifies is that we aren't born experiencing ourselves as connected with a maternal figure, but we from birth experience ourselves as separate. That said, we don't really begin bonding with a particular person until we're able to cognitively handle that, which is more like, and it's been a while since I read this, so I may be a little bit off, but 9, 10 months, something in there, when we begin to get stranger anxiety, when, oh, wait a minute, that person is not mom, and mom is my person. And I think that that's, a period of development that we that kind of 9 months to, and the idea that we move from this to that, it's kind of like we move from the seduction theory to this other theory. The seduction theory is still there, and we add this other theory. I think we start out with a more dyadic experience of other people in our lives. There's one other person that we're interacting with. And the third person is an intruder. That's the Oedipal triangle that I have a relationship with this primary person. And how do I integrate this other person that's clearly important to them and actually important to me as well? But that's a much more complicated situation than just mommy and me, or the mothering one, as Winnicott calls it. And so the Oedipal situation is the situation where we move from a single attachment and start managing a much more complicated field. And so when you start talking, when you suggest the Oedipal situation, I think you're also suggesting something like, I want to marry my mother and kill my father. And okay, that may be an element, but it's a complicated, and it's about the transition from a relatively simple two-person system to a much more complicated three-person, and then four, and then five, and then becoming a member of a family, of a community, of a tribe. And how do we think about that developmental movement?
Yeah. And does it also, I guess, contemporary Oedipal complex thinking, would it also take into attachment, let's say that there was no real primary attachment figure, you know, someone who bounced around foster homes or something, would that be the same that allows neuroses to develop because there was no attachment or Oedipal situation?
And if we talk about the attachment, that's pre-Oedipal. And if I didn't figure out how to attach to anyone, then and I wasn't working from a firm base, when yes, that's going to be an important developmental impediment moving forward. Yes, absolutely.
There was this is kind of a random question, not random, but I was just thinking, so from my understanding, there wasn't a whole lot of trauma theory before. So nowadays we kind of swim in the world of trauma theory, mm-hmm. and you have trauma-informed therapists, and some people can even kind of critique that as, if you see everything through the lens of trauma, then everything's trauma, you know, you need, right. But anyways, right. But back in the late 1800s, you were a lot less likely to have people. There wasn't even talk therapy or like mental, you know, psychologist yet. So the chances that someone would go to someone like Freud, and he's introducing this new form of therapy, and then they would say, I think that I have problems in my current life because of some trauma that happened when I was a child, that wasn't even really in the worldview back then. So it would make sense why they might not go reporting that. But I guess hypothetically, prior to Freud's development of the Oedipal theory, when he was working with, you know, hysterical patients and kind of uncovering abuse, his theory was that, from my understanding, that hysteria was a result of having repressed childhood trauma. And it was because it was repressed, it was coming out in symptoms, i.e. hysteria. But if someone came in, hypothetically, if someone came in reporting childhood trauma, and so the memory, that specific memory that they reported wasn't repressed, but they still had these symptoms, do you know what he, what he would have thought back then? You know what I mean? You have a guess?
I hear that. In the first book that Brouwer and Freud published together, Freud reports on a number of cases, and there's a delightful and very brief case. It's the case of Katerina. And Freud goes on vacation, and he climbs a mountain, and at the top of the mountain, Katerina comes up to him and says, "I work at the inn where you are staying, and I notice that you're a doctor, and I've got these symptoms. Could you help me with them?" And the symptoms that she describes, and Freud works with her to understand the symptoms, but the symptoms that she describes are, she has panic attacks. And the question is, where do they come from? And Freud talks about a conversation that they have together. I'm guessing it takes about an hour. And she, in the course of that conversation, she remembers her, and he tells this in a footnote at the very end, that he had altered this from being her father to her uncle in order to protect her identity. That's really problematic. But her, she discovered that her father was having sex with her, its cousin in the text, and it's not clarified whether that's actually her sister or her cousin. And that leads her to remember a couple of instances where her father attempted to abuse her, to engage in sexual activity with her. And then as she's able to express this, she becomes much less, she becomes vibrant in a way that she wasn't before. There's clearly a lot of work to be done. Actually, her mom has divorced her father over this. Her sister or cousin, I don't know, someone is pregnant and living with the father. It's a mess. There's a lot more work that we would think would need to be done. But what Freud is reporting is this very brief interaction. I think it's hard to imagine that someone would come to him at the top of a mountain and say, "You know, I'm interested. I know you've written about childhood sexuality, and I had sex with my dad, and I'm doing okay." I think that Freud was living in a Victorian era when sex was rampant but not talked about, and to talk about sex was something that people really were tremendously uncomfortable with doing. I think that one of the ways that Freud influenced, one of the huge influences that he had, was that we do talk about sex. And so we maybe way too much and focus on it and are I think that the kinds of symptoms that he saw, we see relatively infrequently now. I think in many ways he's treated, if you will, the culture. And our openness leads us to be less, to have less somatization as a result of things like child sexual abuse. And we're more likely to have anxiety that's expressed verbally rather than bodily, in bodily forms. So I think we're still symptomatic. It still interferes with our development. It's problematic, but it results in a different kind of symptoms. It's hard for me to imagine an environment in which parental sexual interactions would not lead to difficulty.
Yeah. I guess the last question is, I understand the why a psychoanalyst or a psychologist or a therapist would want to place emphasis on the affect or the emotion, or how does that memory, or how does the fact that may have happened impact you now, and how can we work with that? That being said, do you think that Freud maybe prioritized psychic reality a little too much and he could have emphasized external events better?
a lot of the development of psychodynamic thinking, of psychoanalytic thinking, has involved, I mean, Freud was a biologist first and foremost. And he was imagining development unfolding based on a biological agenda that took place across time, and he really didn't appreciate cultural differences. He thought that we were all kind of cut of the same cloth and basically genetically determined. And so a lot of psychoanalytic work has gone on in terms of thinking about culture and how different cultures influence development. I think, yes, his emphasis on the internal world, to the exclusion of the external world, did not accurately reflect the complexity of the human experience. And so a lot of our correction, if you will, correcting the course of psychoanalysis is involved thinking about that on a cultural but also on a familial level, and kind of clarifying that what parents do to children actually does matter a lot.
Yeah.
And kind of returning to the original seduction theory, if you will, and saying it's not the child that creates the world, but their world is created in part by the family and the culture that they grow up.
Yeah, well, Dr. Stukenberg, thank you. This has been helpful. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Dr. Boyne. It's actually been a very stimulating conversation for me, so I appreciate
good.
It.
Good. Dr. Stukenberg, thank you for joining me today.
Good morning, Dr. Boyne. Happy to be here.
Thank you. Would you mind starting off just telling us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. I came to psychoanalysis via an odd route. I was first a patient, and an accidental patient. I went to a workshop on it was a workshop on a role playing workshop, and I assumed I would become a better thespian. I thought that I would become a better actor, but it was really about living your own life, and that led to being in group therapy and also some family therapy in high school. Then I went off to college and read Freud and became intrigued by that at a school that was a liberal arts school. And I was not a psychology major. I didn't know anything about 20th century psychology. I was reading the great books, and that kind of ended with Freud and James. So I applied to graduate school somewhat naively and went to Ohio State, which is not a hotbed of psychoanalytic thought, but worked at a small hospital that was more psychodynamically oriented. And the folks there, many of them had been trained at Menninger. So after my internship in Houston, I did a 2 and it turned into a 3-year postdoc at Menninger in Topeka. And then moved to Cincinnati in part because there was an institute here and I was interested in being part of an analytic community. And it turned out that one way of doing that was to become an analyst. So while I think of myself much more broadly as a psychologist, I have been trained as an analyst and practice as an analyst. But that's kind of a portion of who it is that I am as a clinician and as a thinker.
Yeah. Thank you.